It's January 30th, 2007. This is Ellen Nori Nordhauser. I'm interviewing Professor Earl Latherson, formerly president of SIUE, for the 50th anniversary history of the university.
I can't think of anything that really is off the record, except that from time to time I'm going to have to make comments probably about people. And then those will probably be off the record.
All right. Well, I transcribe this and I send you a copy, and Then you can change or delete or
do anything.
Well, it's your intellectual property.
Well,
you know, you're creating a source.
No, it's, I understand. But
most modern history, you know, depends on people like you are willing to.
Right, I understand. Well,
it's really an honor to see you. I know.
Don't say that.
It's just fantastic.
You know, well, you were always one of my favorite people at the university. I mean, you always had such an optimistic and upbeat view of things. And Norman was really the same way. I mean, you were both delightful people. There are a couple of sources that I'm sure you're aware of, but I'll just mention them in case not. One is, at the time that I retired, my recollection is that they did a booklet. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's called The Latherson Years.
Oh, yes, I've seen that.
Okay.
Good.
Okay.
Yes, Sam Smith loaned me a copy of it.
I just wanted
to... And I took notes on it.
Sure.
I had already taken notes on it in the archives, actually.
Okay. Number two, you remember Louisa Bowen.
Yes.
Lovely lady. Mm-hmm. She, almost immediately after I retired, she sat down with me for an extensive series of interviews. And she recorded it and transcribed it, the same kind of thing. But those are in, I guess, in a sealed part of the archives. And the way that I set it up was I gave them whatever papers I had together with this thing. And my recollection is that they're not supposed to be accessed until 2025. But the reason I mention it is, it might be interesting for you at some point in the future, when they're available, to take a look and see how often I contradict myself. So those things are available. Now, in terms of other things that came to mind as I went through your questions, creation of the School of Engineering.
Yes.
A high point, of course, was when I got the BHE to drop their embargo against housing at the university and got the board to accept housing and actually got approval to move ahead with the building. Let's see. The whole issue of where SIUE faculty stood in regard to other faculty members in the state versus salary. The issue of tuition and fees. Now, let me go back to the salaries. The reason I bring that up is because it was very important to me to ensure that we maintained as high a level the faculty salaries as we could. And as a matter of fact, we were the second highest in the state after the University of Illinois, which caused no ends of problems to Carbondale. And as a matter of fact, my own view is that if there was a reason why our folks did not go union, that probably had a great deal to do with it.
I suggest that it did, ultimately.
Yeah, I think that...
In the second election.
Yeah, exactly.
By then it had begun to come in.
Yes. Exactly. And of course, if you look at the subsequent history of what occurred at Carbondale, even with getting the the unionization, it doesn't seem to me that it really did them much good. If anything, I'm not sure that it didn't do some positive mm-hmm. harm there.
Mm-hmm.
Tuition and fees. I always operated on a view that it was extremely important for the institution to maintain as low a schedule of tuition and fees that we could. And the reason for that was that we were dealing with a population that really didn't have the wherewithal, you know, to provide mm-hmm. monies at a level that are more average mm-hmm. With regard to sending kids to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that issue was extremely important. On the fee side, I always felt that if we were going to spend students' money, particularly on large projects, it was extremely important to get their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It was their money. They ought to have a right mm-hmm. to say how the money was utilized.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when we built the rec building, I had a referendum with regard to that.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that the students were very much in favor, but if they had not been, I would not have gone ahead mm-hmm. with the rec building because they paid for
this
it.
This is the Student Fitness Center,
I'm sorry.
Not the Vidal Center.
Not the
Center.
Vidal, but the
okay.
Student Fitness Center. Okay. I was very happy to get Arts and Issues in place.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting story. I went to Jerry Hollenhorst, who was then the president of the faculty senate. And I said, Jerry, I'll fund it if you can get it through the senate. And he got it through the senate, and I funded it. And I think it's been a great
mm-hmm.
Thing for the institution. University Park.
Yeah, I mentioned that.
I'm very pleased at how that has developed. And I think that that was part, by the way, of a tripartite or quadripartite attempt to get Southwestern Illinois moving economically.
Mm-hmm.
That, the creation of the Southwestern Illinois Development Authority,
mm-hmm.
attempting to do something about the economic status of East St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
Those things were all of a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I viewed them in my own mind. And they were all part also of outreach to the general region.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the university for many years, I see Anna's, you may want to stop it for a minute. She's bringing the tea.
Okay.
Things, and in particular, making some inroads in terms of what I regarded as a very insular view of St. Louis with regard to Southern Illinois and the university.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked very hard at making sure, I went on a kind of propaganda campaign.
Okay.
It took about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it was successful in the sense that by the mid-1980s, people in the region had a much clearer picture
mm-hmm.
of the capabilities of the university, etc. I was very concerned about striking a proper balance between academics and athletics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the situations which, unfortunately, I had to terminate. Mm-hmm. An athletic director.
I write about that, actually. I write about that.
Yeah.
Black and Saguso.
Yes. Yes, exactly right.
I had a big interview with Cindy Jones. She was really great.
Good.
So.
But that was, you know, a situation in which clearly academic rules had been broken. And we just could not.
Yes.
Then.
What year was that? I've tried to find out exactly what year it was. I know, you know, There wasn't that much in the files about it.
It would have had to have been maybe around...
Because I'd like to look in the Globe Democrat. I went over there and looked at a lot of things. And
well, and the student newspaper must have had stuff about
it. Yeah, the Alesto. But I just wanted to know which years, because...
I want the safe bet for me is to say, like, 1985.
Okay.
Because that's sort of in the middle of that decade.
Yes.
And, but, and I can't, I'm not very good now at remembering dates.
Oh, I'm not either. Wow. So, although I'm an historian. But, yeah. So, yeah, Lashbrook was in there for 4 years after.
Yes.
About 4 years after.
That sounds right. Yeah.
The guy that was fired. I can't remember his name, but I would have it in the account. And then Cindy became the director in 88.
Yeah, she was a very
good director. For 12 years.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
She was very good. And I'll mention, let's see, I think on the phone you'd asked me about goals. And it's funny, but at the time that... You got it back on again?
Yeah, it's on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's on.
Okay. At the time that I was appointed president, I had written down on a sheet
of
paper.
I'm just moving it over.
Sure. 12 things that I had wanted to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is that I know that I accomplished all 12. What is not so interesting is right now, with difficulty, I could recreate the list in my head. But, you know, we can talk about that.
This was while you were provost. I think you sent a list to Buzz Shaw.
That's right.
Of these 12 goals.
Yes.
And as usual, he wrote, good job.
Did he?
I just, the files are full of you and very little of him, and most of it says, good girl, good dog, keep going, you know.
all right. Now, I want to mention Earl Beard.
Yes.
Because Earl was an enormous inspiration to me. He was a friend, a mentor. I cannot say enough about mm-hmm. Earl. He touched me in ways that very few people have. There were other people that I worked with who were very helpful. I've mentioned Jerry Hollenhorst. Sid Denny was a great faculty mm-hmm. senate president. I guess I shouldn't spend time on, I should go back to your questions.
No, you don't, you can spend any time, however you want to spend the time.
Well, let me try and, let me reserve myself until last, because that's probably the least interesting thing here. I mean, will be for others, but I'll start with question two.
Okay. Okay.
In working with John Rundleman, John was a very charismatic figure.
Mm-hmm.
He was clearly not very much interested in the academic side of the mm-hmm. institution. My personal interaction with him started when I was dean of the School of Science and Technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been 1974 or 75.
Mm-hmm.
I had put together, with the help of Bill Hoard, who was the chairman of the engineering department, and with Dave Werner and somebody in his shop, whose name I can't remember now, a new degree program.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Construction Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there were very few such programs in the United States at that time. But since then, it's gotten very popular. Mm-hmm. But in any event, I recall there was a luncheon meeting someplace, and I think that's where I probably first really talked to Rendell. Mm-hmm. And he was very happy that this had occurred,
mm-hmm.
this sort of interaction between the Department of Engineering and the School of Business. And about maybe 6 months after that, he asked me to come and visit with him. And he said, I would like you to think about doing something with other institutions in the state relative to energy. And I asked him, you know, can you sort of expand on that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure that I got a clear picture, but he sort of gave me my marching orders. I can remember when I left his office, he said, Lazarson, I want you to go out and bring home the bacon. I remember that very well. What I did following that meeting was sometime later I set up a...
That's my paper card. I don't know what that is.
Okay.
Okay.
With other deans of engineering,
mm-hmm.
in the state. And we got together and we had several meetings, as I recall, to talk about what the universities might do relative to energy programs and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. Nothing much really came of it.
Okay.
But John was very pleased with that.
Mm.
Then I was asked to serve on this committee that you allude to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get this the timing on this in my head. That would have been set up, I think, in the fall.
75.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as you say, Vonnie Lindsay was the chair.
Mm-hmm.
I was a member. I don't really remember the other... Oh, there were members, of course. There was a very distinguished professor at Carbondale,
mm-hmm.
an older man.
Uh-huh.
Who was on it, and some other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my recollection, Ellen, is that the purpose of that was to sort through the succession to Rendleman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, others may have a better remembrance of the specifics, but I am almost positive that we were, that our job was to look into several people who Rendleman had recommended to the Board of Trustees and to come back with some recommendations. And he was recommending them, presumably, to serve as president.
Uh-huh.
When he departed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Well, I the memos that I've seen that he drafted, and one of them's in his own handwriting, was that you were supposed to watch him work, and when you thought he wasn't doing it anymore.
I think that was a minor.
Okay.
I mean, if
maybe that was rewritten by Pete Simpson or
it
something.
It could have been. No, it could have been.
You know.
Yeah.
But I think that's what he thought,
yeah,
of the committee as. They were going to, I won't be able to do this because I love the job too much and I don't want to harm the university.
Well, see, here was the situation.
And he says that in the memo,
yeah,
almost. He almost says that.
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm skipping ahead. I think maybe you're right.
But I don't know.
No, I think you're right.
Uh-huh.
I think you're right. I'm jumping ahead. Because we were still in existence, of course, when he passed away in March, mm-hmm. of 76.
Yes, very early in March,
okay.
He died.
Uh-huh. All right. Then what occurred this is See, what I'm trying to recall is the following. There were two people who had thrown their hats into the ring for a succession.
Well, Coachman wanted to be president. Well, Andrew Coachman.
Yes, he did, very much so. He was the third one. But the other two, one was Dean Wiley.
Yes, that's who I was going to mention next.
And the third one was Rendleman's chief assistant, whose name I can't...
Tom Leffler?
No.
Okay, I know...
You know who I'm talking about?
Metcalf.
Not Metcalf.
The lawyer, John Paul Davis.
No.
Art Greist.
No, this was a guy who was really a political operative for Rendleman.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Anyway, it would have been another politician. I've seen
That's
that
right.
guy's name. He just doesn't appear much in the files.
No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't. But the point was that my recollection is that the committee somehow or other just indicated that that an interim president be appointed, and that then a full-blown search take place,
mm-hmm.
which is what
yes.
occurred. Okay.
Because they already had the new rules for searches.
I think that's
in
right.
the new affirmative action program.
Exactly.
That was part of it. So
yeah.
there couldn't have been just another.
No, but there was something that went on with Wiley and this other fellow.
I'll remember his name one of these minutes, maybe.
No, it's no big deal. Okay, so that was my, up to that point, that was my interaction with John until almost the very end.
Uh-huh.
He called me at 6 o'clock one Saturday morning. And asked me to come and see him.
Uh-huh.
And he was in very bad shape at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with him, I would guess, for 3 or 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to talk about the university in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And he was explaining to me about how, in his view, and I'll say this, but I'd rather this be off the record.
Okay.
He didn't think that Andy could do the job.
Oh, it wasn't an unusual opinion.
No, I know. But I'm not.
I know.
I don't
get into that kind of thing in
okay.
my account anyway.
But in terms of the background,
yes.
And what struck me about, I was just absolutely flabbergasted that. You know, he was essentially on his last legs,
mm-hmm.
and that he would take the time to invite me over to talk about this stuff. I was sort of dumbfounded, really, mm-hmm. because at that time I was, I was still the dean of science and technology, and we hadn't had that much interaction,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. except for the few times that I've mentioned to you,
mm-hmm.
but
well, that was one of the, maybe the very last appointment he had with anyone.
Was it really
in his appointment book? And so that's why I thought, well, maybe he really picked this guy. You know, maybe he saw this guy as someone.
Well, he may have.
Who was
but
coming
he,
up?
He,
you know,
I think he was very careful.
And sure.
Not to.
He was probably still hoping that a miracle would happen.
Yeah, but I'm sure he was. I mean, I. He was full of life right up to the end.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw him in a different light
mm-hmm.
that morning. It was okay. I guess three I've
Well, I asked you about I've written a long chapter on him, not as long as your chapter, but I've tried to say that I thought he was a very strong president.
Yes,
a very good president.
He was.
But that he when the financial crisis came, he didn't have the planning skills.
I wondered
as a dean, you were in a dean during the belt tightening as it began to slide, and I wondered what it was like when the money began to go away.
Tell you what the impact was with regard to science and technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that as soon as I became the dean and realized, you know, the handwriting mm-hmm. on the wall, mm-hmm. I implemented steps within the school that mirrored what I later did mm-hmm. in the university.
Mm-hmm.
Because my view was that nobody is going to do this for us.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that. There wasn't strong leadership. I'm not talking about John now, but I'm talking about academic
mm-hmm.
affairs.
Yes.
So it was extremely important to do what we could for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we were relatively successful, but the budget situation, which is a story in itself, was clearly going to play a major role in the university over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think you're right that Buzz Shaw did give me, he gave me the freedom and the responsibility. you know, I think that, well, Buzz was a joy to work with. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he was a great guy. He was just a wonderful human being. I knew within a year of his arrival on campus as president that he would end up as the system chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
It was just as clear as day. They were having a lot of problems at Carbondale,
mm-hmm.
And Buzz was a very transparent, direct person, the kind that a board would have confidence in, and I think he fulfilled their expectations mm-hmm. when he moved into that slot. But I tell you the truth, I was really sorry when he became chancellor. Not for him, but for myself and for the university, because I thought it would have been wonderful if mm-hmm. he would have stayed on as president.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was just a truly exceptional person in that regard.
So. Yeah, you really do seem to have been a wonderful team.
Yeah, I think we...
During that brief period. And,
yeah, it was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing is forever. Well, you give me, I see a kudo here. As a leader with what I think was a rare ability, blah, blah, blah. How did you formulate your goals? Okay.
I guess I'm just asking if you, when you decided you were going to really move up and how you have such an overview of the institution throughout your public documents that I wondered how you developed. Did you sit at home and make, like Norman, make little drawings and
lists? I do a lot of thinking about things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a prolific writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't, most of my speeches, etc., were off the cuff, many
mm-hmm.
times, unfortunately. I think I tend to communicate better when I don't prepare a script.
Mm-hmm.
When did I start formulating? I guess when I became the provost was when the full impact both of you know, some of the negative aspects of our situation and what the real
mm-hmm.
possibilities were for the future.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Detroit, you know, during the Depression. My father was
worked in a tool and die shop. He was a union member. He was out of work for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some sense of what it was like to be in distressed economic circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this region had a very low graduation rate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people went on to college or university. Most of the people here, at least when during my active years, were place-bound.
Mm-hmm.
So it became very important that they had an institution like the university that could open up the world for them. So that...
Wayne State.
Pardon me?
Wayne State.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Exactly. For me, that was a very wonderful experience, and I felt that the same thing could happen here.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that the university was actually created because a group of people in Edwardsville,
yes,
petitioned the governor to do something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that it's extremely important to remember that in talking about the history of the university,
mm-hmm,
because it was that need that impelled them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And my view was that the university needed to somehow or other respond to that need,
mm-hmm,
both in terms of students and in terms of the broader community. So the goals that I wrote down really had to do with that. I mean, to move the university into a position of increasing strength.
Mm-hmm.
I took very seriously the dictum that you cannot, you know, you can't just walk, you got to crawl before you walk. I don't mean that in any,
mm-hmm,
negative sense, but I think that we had to start building a solid foundation,
mm-hmm,
that would enable us over time, way beyond when I was here,
mm-hmm,
to assume the mantle that I'd hoped that the university would assume.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, and the most important part, was to get in place solid academic programs,
mm-hmm,
that made sense for people here,
mm-hmm,
for the region. So the thought that occurred to me was, there is no reason why SIUE cannot have, you know, high quality,
mm-hmm,
undergraduate programs, a select range of high quality master's level programs,
mm-hmm,
probably oriented towards the professions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, we had the doctorate in education that needed to either be strengthened or got rid,
mm-hmm,
of. I mean, but I did not foresee at that point that we should be spinning our wheels in attempting to secure additional doctorates. It was just not in the cards. The Board of Higher Education never would have gone for it. Our board would never have gone for it because they didn't want any impediments to Carbondale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another long story. But
So
I think that first and foremost, what I tried to do was set in place a vision of what the university could be within that programming context.
Mm-hmm.
And then really everything else sort of flowed from that.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the College of Arts and Sciences,
mm-hmm,
going to a semester system, because it had always been my experience in other institutions that lent itself more readily to sustained learning. I could, you know, that's, some people have another perspective. I mean, I don't. This is not ideology.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to shake the institution.
Yep.
I think getting the embargo lifted on the housing was part of this.
Uh-huh.
So all of these goals that I had written down that sort of shaped my thinking really stemmed from the primary one, which was to provide quality education to, you know, the people that we serve, and at the same time to utilize the university as a resource for the community that we serve. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see where I'm at. Yeah, okay. A portion of the unionization. Well, I tell you the truth, Buzz and I never did anything about unionization. You know, if it was going to happen, it was going to happen.
Well, they spent a lot of money on that law firm.
Oh.
Safeworth.
Yeah,
whatever it was. That was very important to faculty members that was going on, I think.
You mean that?
That the system was spending money on
union busting. I'm sorry.
Law firm. And what I really was asking was, was how much of that was coming from the local level and how much of that was the system, because that was particularly under Pettit.
Yeah, it was the system. Pettit and I, very frank, you don't have to put this in.
Okay.
Pettit and I never got along from day one. I mean, we just didn't.
Well, some people in their interviews have said that was one of the good things you did, was you kind of kept him at bay.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I did. Uh-huh. I mean, in the end, I hate to put it in crass terms, but the truth is, I won, he lost.
Mm-hmm.
The board.
I like that.
Well,
with the board.
With the board.
Yes.
And that was it. He made too many errors in terms of what he was attempting to do, in my view, with Edwardsville. And I cast that in a context which made it very difficult for the board not to understand what my feelings were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the end, they just decided he had to go.
Mm-hmm.
So.
This is kind of jumping ahead, and this is kind of after your time.
Yeah.
It seems like Nancy Belk didn't, the board composition might have changed, but she didn't have that political skill with the board that you did in her time, because Sanders just, you know, got rid of maybe the best president Carbondale ever had a chance of having, and then getting rid of Nancy Belk.
She didn't have.
I'm so surprised the board didn't defend her, didn't support her, and didn't support Joanne Argersinger either.
I
don't understand that. But this is after your time.
Yeah.
The records aren't enough right now to make any speculation about that. Most of the hard information I have about him is on Oracle, you know, from Dan Corbin.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
John Ryder.
Yeah, of course.
Poor David Warner.
Yeah.
And then poor guy now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, it was an interesting thing, because when I left, the board, as you know, changed the titles.
Yes.
And they waited until I left to do that.
Mm-hmm. They did that in 96.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a very good working relationship with the board.
Mm-hmm.
The only serious disagreement that we had to do, I think, with the housing.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't write anything about this, but some other people have speculated that your first provost caused problems with the board. But maybe that was just their wish rather than
I think
reality.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Barbara,
I don't put anything.
I think it was more an interaction with the faculty.
Uh-huh.
The board, I don't think
wanted to get involved in that.
No, they didn't. But the housing, there was a concern on the part of some board members mm-hmm. that if Edwardsville were to get a housing, uh-huh. that would then cause problems with regard to Carbondale. Mm-hmm. And they were right. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, Edwardsville is much, much more attractive. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I just felt that it had to be. It made no sense. If the BHE assented, and they did, mm-hmm. then I thought it was important that our board should support it. Mm-hmm. And they did. I mean, but that was a more difficult thing to achieve with our board than I think anything else that I dealt with. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I don't think that was perceived by anyone else that I've interviewed.
Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe it was perceived by John Reiner, but he had other fish to fry
yeah.
in his interview. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. Let me just... oh, the controversy... Well, wait, I'll go back.
I wondered about the IEA.
I don't remember that. What...
Well, what it was that the legislature had voted a raise before the union election. Then after they voted, they were denied the raise and told, well, they had to bargain for their salary. And then they had to appeal, of course, and of course they won their appeal because of the chronological
right.
sequence there. And I just wondered, I didn't, you know.
That's not
and John Drewke certainly didn't make you a bête noire in that particular case.
No, I don't think this. I'm sure this goes back to the board directing that this had to be done.
And probably.
Yeah, I'm sure that because
they had really stonewalled for a long time
yes.
before that law made
yeah,
it
yeah.
for. So.
Let's see. Selection of deans. Well, my view was that I had the responsibility to, in effect, administer the university. I never questioned the faculty's primacy with regard to setting the academic program and uh-huh. all adjunct matters connected with academic programs. But the deans, I felt, while they had to in effect be Janus-headed, namely they had to pay attention to the faculty mm-hmm. and to the administration. As far as their selection was concerned, it seemed to me that if I were to do my job, I had to have deans who, they didn't have to kowtow or be loyal, mm-hmm. but I wanted people that I felt that I could reasonably get along with.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, I remember the thing came to a head over the selection, as I recall, it was maybe it wasn't even a selection, but just a process being set up in the School of Education.
Yes, that was the beginning. That was the first one.
Yeah. Right. And even after, and I wrote, I think, an extensive memorandum to the community about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also remember that... you know, there were issues that I was willing, you know, to compromise on. For example, I think, with regard to the School of Social Sciences, we agreed on a removal apparatus. Does that ring a bell?
It may be in there, but
I think there
really
is. I think that the school. I remember, now, who raised it?
John Farley, probably.
Maybe so.
Yes. I have notes that say John Farley raised the issue of the new policy doesn't do anything about a dean that
exactly.
is unpopular.
And I agreed with the language that the school suggested.
It does seem to me, this isn't how I put it in the chapter at all, but it does seem to me like that some of these deans that they had were so good, like Carol Keene and Suzanne Jacobiti. I mean, you could hardly find
yeah, no,
more wonderful
right.
people.
Right.
than them. And then the ones that replaced them were, while they were, you know, okay, they were...
Well, that's undoubtedly true.
And, yeah.
But I mean, they had come to, what, the ends of their terms? And
well, they could have gone on.
On.
Yeah. Without the new process, they could have gone on.
Right.
Right. But then Suzanne refused to go on,
yes,
you know.
Right.
And Carol just went on to other, you know, other political things.
She's a
politician. So. You've already told me something about the IBHE.
Yes, a little bit. Okay, well...
But I'm still not really clear about that.
Sure. Let me make some comments and see if there are any help. My understanding historically was that, and I saw some of this myself, John's way of dealing with the IBHE was to sort of set them up as the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that went across very well at home, but the board didn't like it, and the IBHE, of course, didn't like it at all. Buzz came in, and he had a very good working relationship with the IBHE, and when I came in, my view was, you know, I'm not interested. We were staring, you know, down the muzzle of the gun. I mean, I can remember the first legislative session that I attended, which dealt with the budgets for higher education.
Mm-hmm.
They had a big tableau up in front of the budget committee, which showed, here are all these schools, you know, the average cost per student, and they're down here at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
There's one spike, SIUE. We were something like 30% mm-hmm. above the average.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this was at the time when there was a lot of, you know, talk about, well, we need to get rid of a couple of universities.
And, mm-hmm.
It was not a very good prospect. But in any event, I thought that it would be much better to try and work with them and manage the process of budget reduction internally rather than having it shoved down our throat. Mm-hmm. Although they're, you know, they clearly have the power to make recommendations to the legislature mm-hmm. any way that they want it.
Mm-hmm.
But the key person that I worked with was Dick Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very, very good executive director. His heart was in the right place, in my perspective, about what universities ought to be doing in terms of paying more attention to undergraduates, you know, trying to cut operating mm-hmm. costs and get some of that burden off of students, et cetera. So we enjoyed a splendid relationship for the bulk of the time that I was president. He was a friend
mm-hmm.
of the university.
This is related to the budget issue. As with the deans, you had to get control of the budget. And I interviewed Luther Statler. And he never said exactly what the issue was, but I gathered that he was the old loose fiefdom kind of person, and you were the person who wanted to manage every penny.
No,
that wasn't it. So
well,
I didn't write about it because I couldn't quite.
Well, no, I mean, let me see if I can get my thoughts in order.
He said that you and he had words.
But that was much later.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'll tell you.
And I thought maybe it was over budgetary questions.
No. What happened was that I appointed Luther as director of
physical plant.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. And and in the course of that, you know, every year I met with the heads of the various departments.
Yes.
We talked about budget, and so I
talk to Luther about his budget, et cetera, and he didn't like what he heard, so he resigned.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Well, that when I say he resigned, he sent me a letter, and I called him in, and I said, are you serious about this? I said, if you are, then I'll accept it. If you're not, tell me now. And oh, he said, I'm not serious.
Oh, okay.
A year later, he pulled the same thing. And this time, I did not call him in. I simply wrote him a letter and said, I appreciate your dedicated service, and I accept your resignation. Because I just didn't want to.
Right.
I don't like to play around like that.
Okay.
The larger budget issue went something like this. The BHE determined, and I can't remember these figures, so please be gentle.
Yes.
That initially we were $15 million overfunded. And they gave us a workout period. And I decided that this, you know, had enormous implications for the future of the institution, and I didn't want to simply make determinations in a vacuum. And that led to the creation of the University Planning and Budget Council. And I think during the first 6 months or so of our meetings and discussions, I made it very clear that if it was the will of the faculty that they did not want forced reductions in numbers, that then it would have to be handled by simply not, when a position became vacant, not filling it. Making cuts in support costs, making cuts in administrative costs as much as we could do. In effect, you know, look at every nook and cranny. Well, that's what we did. In effect, we didn't fire anybody. Now, you know, whether that was the best thing to do or not, I don't know. It was the path we took. I thought that everybody had an opportunity to register their perspective through their representatives. I mean, not only the faculty, but the professional staff, civil service, etc. And I think that a minimum amount of damage was done to the institution, and I think, in fact, it came out really much stronger than when it had gone in.
Was the UPBC a unique institution, or was it something, did you read about it in the Chronicle, or book you were always reading about?
I stayed away from professional education books as much as possible. I mean, I'm not an educator in that sense. I'm not an administrator, I should say. And I attended meetings where you know, I talked to other people and stuff like that. But, I mean, that, you know, there's not much creativeness about the University Planning and Budget Council. It's a pretty obvious thing. If you're going to consult, you've got to have a mechanism, and that was the mechanism.
So it was unique. It wasn't anywhere else in Illinois at any other school.
Not that I'm aware of at that time. There may have been, but I don't know.
Well, John Reiner says the same thing about his inventories of people's work effort, that wasn't really going on either. I mean, he's very modest about it, but
yeah,
he was really doing a heroic job, I think.
Yes.
In the same.
Yes, exactly.
Effort, you know, to look in all the nooks and crannies.
Let's see, anything else that you want me to comment on about the BHE or the dental school? That was a very interesting
Yes, I wondered about the dental school because there's nothing in the files that really tells how you did it.
Okay, I'll tell you. Well, it was a bolt from the blue, first of all, because what happened was that the University of Illinois and Northwestern apparently made representations to the BHE that there were too many dentists being produced in the state. And, you know, we didn't need all these dental schools. Now, what they omitted in their representations to mention was that the rural areas were not particularly well served, nor were the Rust Belt cities along the Mississippi. I got the word, we're going to shut down the dental school. I went to the BHE and said, you know, we need to make our case. You've got to hear us out on this. And, of course, there was no problem. I mean, they did things reasonably. So what they did, they assembled a committee of members of their board together with staff people and said that let us know when we can come and visit, et cetera. So I called a war council. And I wish I had it, but I don't. I wrote on a sheet of paper some steps that we could take. We could, first of all, who were our natural allies in this case? Well, clearly Alton.
Yes.
And secondly, East St. Louis. You see, I had maintained that dental clinic in East St. Louis, even though the dental school didn't want it. And the reason I maintained it was because it gave us a political foothold there. So I started out with, you know, I talked with local legislators. I remember Sam Wolf, Vidala Bean, Kenny Hall. Kenny was very important. He's a senator whose territory encompassed East St. Louis, and Wyvetta Young, and asked them to do everything that they could to rouse public opinion.
Yes.
And that's exactly what happened. We scheduled a meeting for the BHE committee in Alton. The auditorium was packed. The committee couldn't believe its eyes and ears with, you know, these people one after another testifying how important it was. And if that opened their eyes, when we got to East St. Louis, we had singing and dancing. So, I mean, the point was that, you know, there was a great outpouring of public support. Well, the committee went home, and at the next BHE meeting, they recommended that that the dental school be maintained. Now, before that vote was taken, I had reached an agreement with Dick Wagner, the executive director, that if it was affirmative that the BHE would support constructing a new dental school building in Alton.
Yes.
And they followed through. So that was a very, very satisfying. I mean, what I liked about it was a fight, you know, it got your blood up. And to see the people respond in the way that they did was, I mean, it was a terrific feeling. They needed us, and it was great.
John Ryder also mentioned that the School of Dental Medicine had plans for a large enterprise here on the campus, and that you put that on the block as a trade for the new dental clinic.
Well, I was going to go for a they wanted a $25
million
dollar
building,
and that was just not in the cards.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's nice to know that story. That's wonderful.
the experiment in higher education. That got started long before, I think.
Yes, that started in 66.
You're right. Yeah. And so I really can't comment on it. By the time, let me tell you, with regard to East St. Louis, when Coachman appointed me the acting provost in the spring of 76, mm-hmm. I decided that I knew that I needed to get out and visit these other two campuses mm-hmm. and see what was going on. So I set him aside, I think it was the month of either June or July, mm-hmm. and I spent the entire month in East St. Louis interviewing the members of the staff, talking to students, et cetera, trying to uh-huh. figure out how best, you know, to move forward. Because I think at that time, EHE may have been off the books. I just don't recall.
Not in 76. I think that happened in 78.
78, okay. That may be
after Shaw.
Okay, all right.
Took over.
But I remember that, and, you know, hearing what people were saying about...
it had changed. Its curriculum had changed.
It had.
They had tried to align everything with the general education
program. That's it. I mean, nothing was working. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't working. And it was clear that something more dramatic would have uh-huh. to be done. I thought that the spending the month there was extremely useful uh-huh. in that regard. Let me see. It says, it seems that you had to carry out a policy of the Shaw years. Well, I'm sure that whatever the policy was, which I don't remember right now, I mean, I'm sure I must have recommended it to Buzz.
Yes.
So,
the buck stops there.
Right, okay. Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, okay.
Well, then I'll just ask you about this. Again, I think this was an issue with faculty, and it was an issue of the, regardless of the individuals, you know, I've interviewed Janet McReynolds and people about this, and this isn't her point of view I'm representing, but a lot of faculty felt that there were tenured individuals in the experiment in higher education who had been tenured under the old policy where you had tenure in the university. And during the controversy, and this is during the board, when they decided to eliminate it, changed the definition of tenure to tenure in the department. And that was used as the standard to then fire, you know, deny those people tenure. And some stayed on and some went other places. But that was a very, for many faculty people, that seemed like a terrible thing to do. And I say this regardless of the individuals, just that they had been tenured. And then they were they didn't have tenure anymore, and they were the new definition was after they had been granted tenure. So I don't know if that's really ever been sorted out in a scholarly way. There's a little literature on the but none of it really delves into this issue. And
I don't know how to respond.
And so many of the black faculty were lost because of that, because I mean so many. You know, we had a lot of black faculty on the books anyway, and in people's minds, I think.
Well, help me out here.
East St. Louis people's minds.
They were tenured in the experiment in higher education.
Yes, they were tenured in the university, though. Their tenure was in the university. That's how the old tenure policy was. Before, I think, 1977, the board announced tenure is now within a unit. When the unit is eliminated, the tenure is eliminated. But they had been tenured under the old system. And it seems like this was one of those, you know, one of those things you had to do. Like when you had to do the CAS, you just had to do it, and you just had to write and say, well, some things, you know, I think that this is probably one of those things, too. But
I wish that I could recall better. I remember, as I said, the time I spent in East St. Louis,
I don't remember a direct line between that and whatever the recommendation was that I made to Shaw. And I'm sure that I do remember...
you gave them lots of options.
Options.
But...
yeah.
But not within the context of being
I think you're right. I'm sure that... I'm sure that being tenured back in the university was not one of them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But, oh, well, the other thing I wondered about East St. Louis is that it seemed to me that there were a lot of personality conflicts there within the community of Black administrators. And I wondered, I've noticed in interviewing, I wasn't able to interview Professor Jason because he was... I did interview Art Greist, it just seems I read a lot of published interviews of Emil Jason, and
yeah.
It seems like he really had some ideas that have since come to pass, like criminal justice program for, but he wanted it to be in East St. Louis, and he had a lot of good ideas.
He did.
And he got a lot of money in there.
He did.
He was very successful,
right.
But I just wonder what was the problem with working more with him, or was that?
Well, Emil and I had worked together for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
But I think to put it in stark terms, it was Emil's way,
or no way. Okay,
and. We used to meet on a regular basis and talk. We must have talked about these things thousands
yes.
of times. And there was never a resolution of this. I think, frankly, that Emil felt that he never got the recognition from the university that he should have.
Mm-hmm.
And how he saw that, I'm not sure. Well.
Okay. It just seems like he had a lot of them.
He had good ideas.
Good ideas, and he didn't just talk about them. He usually worked them out. He wrote a lot of kind of detailed discussion of his ideas, and then when they closed the experiment in higher education, when there were no baccalaureate programs being offered down there, he got very angry.
Yes, he was very angry.
That's a problem of sources and just speculate about that.
He was a very passionate man about certain things,
mm-hmm.
And I respected him for that, but I also knew that there were legitimate ways of doing things within the institution, and other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I was the president, I felt that we had to do things legitimately.
Okay.
Niederlander?
I haven't written a word about the MRF. I wrote 50 pages on John Rendleman without mentioning it. I don't think it was very important to him, as it's been argued by...
Yeah, it may not have been. I think that...
He just left it up to Metcalf. He had told him to find the money. And
that, you know, again...
That's probably hard on Metcalf.
Well, this is off the record.
Yes. You can turn it off. That looked like a mess.
Let's see. Well, in terms of number 10... I don't know. I don't think I can pick out any one thing as being the most challenging. I think that trying again to move the university in terms of that initial sense I had of building the strongest undergraduate program that we could, strong selective master's degrees.
Uh-huh.
And then providing services to the community that mm-hmm. were in line with the strengths of our faculty. That was the job, and I hope that you know, we move forward.
Yes, I think several people that I've interviewed, like Doug Ader and John Meisel, really felt that you settled the question of what was the direction of the university, and they were really positive about that.
Well, there had been so much confusion. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's just the way things happened, you know. They hired a lot of faculty in the beginning, young PhDs for the most part, who had the only experience they had was with, you know, where they went to graduate school, and they thought they would replicate it. And nobody paid much attention to why, you know, the university came into existence in the first place. So consequently, when things got a little tough and they and things weren't in line with those initial expectations, I we had a problem. And getting that cleared up was fell to me.
Yes. And then I asked about Sam Dalabin.
Yeah, well, Sam, of course, was a tremendous support for the institution. He sort of sucked all the air out of, you know, the space that he was in. In other words, it made it difficult for other politicians. But we had, at least during the time that I was in office, he was there, Kenny Hall, who again, I can't say enough about.
Bob Brooker told me about stuff about Kenny Hall.
Did he?
Yeah.
He's a great guy. Governor Thompson, straight shooter for me, I mean. And the same with regard to Edgar. I had good relations with our federal legislators. And of course I got to know them fairly well. Jerry Costello early on had asked me to, he had, you know, East-West Gateway rotates the chairmanship across, back and forth across the river. So he was the chairman when this occurred. He came to me and asked me to chair a regional committee to look into the bridge problems. So back in the 80s, based on that work, East-West Gateway issued a booklet about the problems with the bridges, et cetera, which was sort of the, how would you say it, the first step in, you know, moving toward doing something. And then after that, I got together with the former mayor of St. Louis, John Pelker, and Bob Hyland, and a couple of other people, and we purchased the vet, well, at that time, I guess it was called the Veterans Bridge.
Jefferson Barracks Bridge?
No. It's what we call today the Martin Luther King Bridge.
Okay.
That had, East St. Louis owned it. We purchased it. We defeased the bonds on it and turned the bridge over to the two states.
Okay.
And that's how Illinois came to refurbish it.
Okay.
So that was a very...
That would make... There must be a lot of information on that.
There probably is. I did a lot of stuff like that. That was in line with, you know, again, getting...
Well, now, how did the East, where did the East-West Gateway get the capital to buy a bridge? I mean, it
They didn't. We hired
consortium
a
consortium of banks, or
We hired a lawyer. We got the money pledged from the state.
Okay.
And the lawyer, his job was to
get rid of all the entailments. And he did. He did a superb job. And
okay. Yeah. Well, you made your own list of subjects here. And
we talked about housing.
Mm-hmm.
I've told you the business about academics and athletics.
Yeah.
On the outreach side, I haven't really talked about Southwestern Illinois Development Authority or my work with the RCGA, but you probably have got stuff on that.
There's a lot of that in the Lazarson years.
Okay. I mentioned arts and issues. I really am very proud of how I kept down tuition and fees.
Okay.
That was, and kept up salaries. And of course, there was a lot of building that went on, but I'm not going to go through all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know if you were aware of this or not, but I created something that, I don't know what it was called even, but it was a luncheon group. I think we got together once a month or on a periodic basis.
Mm-hmm.
And they were faculty members. You mentioned Carol Keene was there, Jacobetti. Sid Denny.
Carol Keene mentioned it in an interview.
Oh, okay.
She did mention it.
Yeah. And that was sort of interesting. We talked about, you know, whatever came up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And no records were kept of those conversations.
No. They were always giving me lessons on the philosophical bases of power.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, you know.
Well, I could ask you about the, speaking of that, I could ask you about the management audit team.
Oh,
I
yes.
interviewed Dennis
well, I
Hostetler.
Think they were very, very good things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really enjoyed the work that those folks did. I think
Bud Hirsch, another great guy.
Yeah. They were good people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't interviewed him, but I always thought he was one of the greatest guys around. I interviewed Marcia Pirro.
Yeah, Marcia, right. She was on this other thing also.
Yeah.
That I mentioned.
Uh-huh. Well, anything else?
God.
I think this, I know.
You know, I tell you, half these things I wouldn't have remembered if you hadn't jotted. Really.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's helpful.
Well, thank you very much
You're more than
for
welcome.
A rich conversation.
And